This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, State Representative Tracy Davis joins me in studio. The number to call if you'd like to get in on the conversation is 549-2937. Then later, the North Florida Land Trust pushes to preserve Fish Island. Plus, road trip ideas for the long weekend. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, the Honorable Tracy Davis is in her second term representing the 13th District of the Florida House of Representatives. Her district covers portions of Jacksonville's urban core, downtown, and Arlington. Tonight, she'll be hosting her second of two town hall meetings since the session closed back in May. The meetings are designed to inform her constituents on the 2019 legislative session, and Davis plans to cover such issues as the new laws regarding the use of medical marijuana, charter school expansion, and follow-up information regarding the Amendment for Ballot Initiative. Representative Davis is here to give us a preview of tonight's town hall and perhaps give us a deeper dive into what we can expect from the next legislative session. Good morning, Representative Davis.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Great, great. And the number to call again is 549-2937. What are your questions do you have for her? And what do you think about what happened in the last legislative session back in the end of May? So let's get started. I know you had a great, robust session, always is. For folks who haven't been attended or kind of keep an eye on the legislative session, there's a lot of give and take, a lot of working together. What do you see? What do you think were some of the big wins and losses for this session?
That's a hard question sometimes. I love when people ask that. It depends on what side you're on sometimes, and we do know we're in a Republican-led legislature. So I think some of my colleagues walked away saying they won really big. But we did have some really good things that passed. If you're talking across the board, we passed a bill that went into effect yesterday, the texting while driving, which was really personal to me, a bill we passed for incarcerated women, and that was, you know, kind of bringing their dignity back to them. And so we passed a ton of education stuff, and some of it good, some of it not so good. But I know we'll talk all about that this morning. So robust is definitely a great description of the last session.
Okay. So you've been in since the short time, you've only been there, it's your second term, but in your short time there, many of the people who've worked with you, I've heard, you know, just from conversation with talking with other members, is that you do a great job of working across the aisle.
Thank you.
You have a lot of support from people who we normally wouldn't be able to get support from. But with that being said, your first session versus your second session, you had a previous governor, Rick Scott, was there, and now you have a new governor. What were some of the differences that you saw in working across two administrations?
So just to describe it, I know a lot of people have an image of Governor Scott, and he really was that type of governor that had something on his mind. He had a goal. He had an agenda. And really coming from that first session, it was his agenda. And it was, I need you guys to get on board with my agenda. No ifs, ands, or buts about it,
to be honest. Would you say his agenda was more conservative than the current Governor DeSantis?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure if I would say it was more conservative. I would say that Governor DeSantis he's showing that he's more inclusive governor. And so I think there's still that conservative agenda there. Yeah. And we see it in a lot of our education legislation that got through. But he is definitely more inclusive. He is definitely willing to sit down and have the conversation. And we have had that. That's very encouraging. And so I tell people when they have that question for me that I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, you know, you can look at his record, and within the first 2 or 3 weeks he was there, he did some things that Governor Scott wouldn't do in the 8 years he was there. And the first thing was the Groveland 4. Mm-hmm. And so we were very excited about that. And that was something that my colleagues had been working on before I even entered the legislature.
Yeah, and I think also people gave him credit for making good on some promises to get to work on environmental issues early on. And I think that probably set the stage for a better working relationship, I should say.
Absolutely. Like I said, he's more inclusive, very much so.
Okay. So you had some controversial legislation there. There was a Schools of Hope expansion going on. We've seen the conversation around the expansion of charter schools in the state of Florida. This is seen as something that many school districts have to grapple with in terms of sort of equalizing opportunities for public education.
Right.
How do you think that the expansion of the Schools of Hope legislation will impact Duval County and your constituents?
Well, first of all, let me explain what the Schools of Hope do and what that bill did for us. So it, and I'll be the first, let me preface this conversation with Democrats get a bad rap when it comes to our charters. And just for clarity, our charters are public schools as well.
Okay.
And that's something that's a conversation goes back and forth all the time. And so I'll be the first to say I'm not that Democrat that's against charter. I am, and I think Jacksonville, Duval County does a great job with offering choice for our parents. And parents should have a choice. They should have a choice of traditional schools. They should have a choice of a charter school. They should have the choice of sending their child to a private or religious school. We have, as Democrats, a challenge with the way these different schools are funded. And we feel like the funding that is should be going to our traditional public schools are being taken, and our traditional public schools are not being funded equally across the board as our other entities or charter. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we stand with this. And that's personally where I stand with that. But with School of Hopes, it allows charter schools to now open up near consistently low performing schools. It actually allow charters to open up in these new opportunity zones that we have around the city. And I think Duval County has 14 identified opportunity zones, and it actually creates a new voucher type program called the Family Empowerment Scholarship Program, which opens up the voucher system to where our state funds are now paying for private students to attend private and religious schools. And so there are a lot of nuances to this legislation, but it also does some good things. It allows some new certification testing made easier for our teachers. It actually extends the temporary certificate for another additional 2 years. And, you know, we have 18,000 children that can take use of this scholarship on an annual basis. So it's not all bad, but it's some
Would you
things.
Say that this actually, because last year when Schools of Hope was passed, the legislation was passed, there were some discernment about how heavy-handed it was in terms of helping charter schools versus supporting public schools. Do you think this expansion helps equalize some of that?
It's still heavy-handed.
Okay. Right.
It's still heavy-handed. It actually extends the hammer, in my opinion.
All right. The number to call is 549-2937 if you'd like to get in a conversation with State Representative Tracy Davis. And we do have a call on the line. Susan is on the line. Susan, good morning.
Good morning. I would like for people to quit calling charter schools public schools because they're privately managed. A lot of we're worried about the funding for the real estate and how the taxpayer may get screwed on that. So it's misleading to call them public schools. So if we could just put a modifying adjective in that, like perhaps publicly funded schools, maybe that would work. Or it's just to call the neighborhood schools, the magnet schools, and the charter schools all public schools when there's a huge variance. So that's the one thing I would like to say.
Okay.
And so thank you.
Thank you, Susan. And that seems to be that's a common thought between people who believe that charter schools are sort of invading opportunities for improvement of traditional public schools.
Right.
Of course, the framework of which charter school operates is that, you know, you get private organizations that are taking advantage of or using public dollars in order to function
yeah.
or to form an option for a public school education.
And I'll just great point, Susan. And I'll just preference my comments by saying when you're dealing with or talking about the public school versus the charter schools, the public school, the school district has to approve the charter for setup. Yeah. So they actually consider themselves the approver of that charter school. And that's how we get that nuance with charter is actually public as well. But she made a great point.
Yeah. And the districts, the school boards are the ones who approve them.
So
they're the ones who provide the scrutiny at the very beginning. And then they have to hold them accountable
Correct.
To go through the process. So, good. All right. The number to call is 549-2937. We're speaking with State Representative Tracy Davis about the past legislative session and some other areas. I know that you talked a little bit about some of the things in that bill, but you're also going to cover this evening, I believe, financial literacy, workplace education, and that legislation that passed and made it, that's going to make it sort of easier for people when they're going to teach students in middle school, financial literacy, correct?
So this was one of those things where you say you have some things that you pass that you're not particularly in love with, but financial literacy, it was a bill that was around a long time. It was around before I even came into the legislature, but it actually expands our apprenticeship programs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So with expanding of the apprenticeship programs, it also allows the school districts to offer financial literacy for one half credit as an elective for the students. And it requires the middle school students to take a course in career education planning. So a lot of good things in that financial literacy bill. We're always talking about the workforce and workforce training and how we need to expand our apprenticeship programs. And this is a way to do it. And so this is something we were really proud of.
Is this sort of a course correction? Because I know that there's been some pressure, in the past on making students take more advanced math classes, math courses. And in return, they have not been able to take more traditional math courses that would allow them to inherently be able to have financial literacy within the curriculum. So this may be some sort of course correction to help bring that back into the system.
I'm not sure if it's a course correction, Charles, but I think it's a course complement.
Okay.
Because when you take away something, you definitely need to replace it. But with our workforce and the way our economic development and our communities are going, and we're losing people who have job skills and things like that, the expansion of apprenticeship programs is huge in our communities. And so I would look at this as a course complement instead of a course correction.
Okay. So, normally what happens is July 1st comes and we get all of these new laws. And one of the more popular ones that kicked off yesterday was the texting while driving law, right? And
yes.
And while that is a good law, we believe that we want to do something about distracted drivers. What do you see? Some of the people, I've heard people talk about this is maybe kind of an opportunity for law enforcement to stop people, because it's a primary offense now, to stop people without a reason other than to say that they thought they were using their cell phone.
So when we're in the legislature, and this was a huge debate, I think this debate went on for a couple of hours, because there is a nuance to this. With this particular law now, and I've heard that conversation too, but this particular law, again, was really personal to me. I lost my sister in 2011 to a distracted driver. She was jogging in Tallahassee, and she was hit and killed by a distracted driver on site. And so to have that conversation with people, I do think this is a law that we'll come back to the drawing board with, because in this law, we have the police officer identifying the race of the person that's being ticketed, but we are not identifying the race of the police officer giving the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the imbalance that's happening with this law. There's an annual report that'll be produced from that. But I think that door is open, but I'm going to be positive and not go down that road. We have more.
Not just yet.
We have more deaths and accidents that happen with people are when they're distracted while driving. And so I know it's going to decrease those numbers. And we had to do something to begin to save lives in that. This area. And so I think this is a first step to that, but we will have to come back and do some adjustments with this law.
Okay, very good. It's a great first step, sounds like, to get it going, but we'll see how it works out. Let's go to the phones. Doran is on the line. Good morning, Doran.
Good morning, Charles. I wanted to make a suggestion. I'm not a big fan of charter schools the way that we're utilizing them right now in the state of Florida. I think if we, as the public and taxpayers, have to support charter schools as an option to our traditional neighborhood schools, I think we should get something for that money. Meaning, we should encourage and actually begin to require, I think, charter schools, when they renew their contracts and any new charter schools, require that they be willing to be utilized as pilot programs, especially focusing on different kinds of methodologies and different types of curriculum, so that we can kind of use them as a test basis for traditional public schools, finding ways to help different kinds of groups that are struggling in the traditional school system, the students who are in under-resourced or in minority schools. You know, schools that are struggling, let's use the charter schools to figure out ways to solve the problems that are plaguing those underperforming schools. That's my recommendation.
All right. Thank you, Doran, for that. Doran is advocating for more of a return on investment and how charter schools operate. Let's take another call. We're going to go to Ty. Good morning, Ty.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Great.
Hi, Tracy. How are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm glad that you have your position in the legislature. I watch the legislature religiously. My question is about education, which seems to be the focus of a lot of callers this morning. My concern is that Education Commissioner Corcoran, that him being in that position and that there's a conflict of interest with his wife also being like an owner of a charter school. So I would like your thoughts about that. I'd also like to know if there's like any thoughts regarding changing a specific aspect of charter schools. Like here in Duval County, we know that students can begin the school year at a charter school, but then for some reason, for any particular reason, if that student is expelled from a charter school, he or she comes back to a public school, and the dollars don't follow that child. So is there any thought about legislation saying that there has to be a clawback from those charter schools for the payment of that kid so that the Duval County Public Schools or any public school has the burden of trying to educate that kid without having the finances available?
And I didn't catch your name, Colin.
That's my question.
Ty. Hey, Ty, how are you?
Thank you, Ty, for your question and your comment.
So, and I'm
going to, okay. Yes, please.
So thanks, Ty, for calling in. I appreciate it. So the conflict of interest question that you asked first was definitely and is definitely something that always stays on the focus of our minds. I have several colleagues that have involvement with charter. Either they're on the board or their family supports it, or they have family members that work there. So that's always been an issue. It's just never been challenged. So, and the issue remains on the table, but again, it's never been challenged. But just like you thought about it, there are several of us that realize that issue. And so to be frank, it's just a matter of...
If you all think it's an issue, what's the process of addressing it? For a citizen like Ty, who...
Raising the question. Okay. Raising the question as a body, raising the question as a community, raising the question as a citizen. We do have a commissioner that's in that, and she's absolutely right, that's in that position, and he's guiding our school system, and you would want to say that we have a commissioner that's free of all the nuances of a charter or private or any type of religious school and having that connection. Yeah. And so I think it's a conversation that we need to continue to have until someone maybe takes this up as an issue. Okay. But up until this point, it seems like no, it hasn't been an issue.
Okay.
And so the second one, I think part of her question was changing the system where the money isn't following the child. And so it's always about the dollars and cents. And so that's always been an issue. But let's I'm going to be as frank as possible. As long as we have a Republican-led legislature that has no problem with the way this system is set up, because they are setting it up, it will continue.
Even your relationships across the aisle can't.
Not with this one. Not with this one.
Well, as Ty mentioned, that this is a pretty hot topic for conversation this morning, given all the other things that are going on. And we do have another call. Charles is in Arlington. Charles, what are your questions for Tracy Davis?
Good morning, Charles. How are you today?
Doing great.
Charles and Charles.
Good to talk to you again. I just wanted to comment that I thought that the government the government itself, especially the state of Florida, has no business issuing scholarships or vouchers in order to send students to a religious school on the basis of separation of church and state, and just on the basis of private schools, there is a competition between private schools and public schools. Why should we be sending students vouchers to go to private schools when we have difficulty in financing our public schools? You can see we're trying to raise money with a new tax, and can't even get the Republican government of the city to allow the school board to hold an election to vote in a new sales tax.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that question and comment, Charles. It seems like, you know, that is still an argument and a concern for some citizens. Believe that, hey, you know, why are we funding these schools anyway if they're being run privately? This was, you know, of course, advocated for, set up as an alternative to public school system.
Yes.
What can citizens do if, you know, they want to have a different system altogether? Is, you know, advocacy is the key, correct?
Absolutely. We cannot stop advocating. I like the comment, of course, that Charles made about the sales tax.
Yes.
Because that's a local issue that we're fighting.
Now, let's talk about that for a little bit. And one of the, from what I understand, is one of the reasons why that the district is proposing a sales tax referendum is because the legislature has not properly funded infrastructure for schools over the years. Is that correct?
That's the basic.
And
yeah.
So districts are using this as a mechanism to fund their needs outside of the legislature.
Correct. And the other issue is that our, in my opinion, I'll preface it, in my opinion, the city council has taken a stance in a manner that was not dictated by the other counties or commissions in our surrounding counties. So, and I think Clay County was the most recent that just added, decided that they would have their voters vote for a sales tax referendum to fund their schools. And so
they still have to have their commission approve it, but they don't think it's going to be a problem.
It's not a problem, right? Because the issue for us is we know the city council's job was to decide on the date and nothing more. Mm-hmm. And our city council took a whole nother route with that, and we were simply not in agreement with it. And we still just simply wanted the voters to have the opportunity to vote on it in 2019, mm-hmm. because the rules change in January 2020.
Now, what are the rule? The rule change comes from the state?
It's the legislature.
Okay,
yeah.
And that rule change is?
It states that this type of referendum will have to go on a general election ballot.
Okay.
Only.
So in 2020, when they move to the general election ballot, they'll have little more than a year in order to convince the public that
this is what we want.
Is worth it.
And then the monies wouldn't be received until the following year.
Okay. All right. Okay. Very good. All right. So let's move on to, I know we've got people wanting to talk about school, but we still have a few other areas to cover before I lose you. Amendment 4, right?
Yeah.
That was another referendum, and you're going to do some updates for that this evening. And what we understand is the governor signed into law the requirements that returning convicted felons have to have in place before they can vote.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that, and what are next steps regarding those thoughts?
Thoughts on that simply is that Amendment 4, as the voters voted on it overwhelmingly, I think by 64%, in my opinion, was a self-executing amendment. We agreed with the definition of murder and sex. That was fine. But when the body decided to add the court fines and fees and to the Amendment 4 that now mandates someone to pay the restitution, the court fees, the fines, whatever may be instituted, was then taking it out of the realm of what the voters voted for. And it was not, it's just not what we said yes to.
Mm-hmm.
And so the latest events that I've seen where a couple of entities have now filed lawsuits behind what is now Amendment 4 in the Civil Rights Restoration. And we knew that was coming. But the next steps simply is for someone to register. Because the challenge is, at this point, we do not know where the person is getting that final cost from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know if they're going to get it from the parole system when they come out, when they exit parole or their probation. We don't know if they're going to get a bill. We don't know if this is a court-ordered situation that the judge is doing. We don't know where that cost is going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so that confuses people. And I think it's just a matter of it's fear now, because now you're not going to get that person to register because they're fearful of the cost that comes behind it, because if they're coming out of the penal system, I don't think they can afford a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand dollars.
If they have to pay restitution.
Right.
That was part of the adjudication.
And now you've added another couple of hundred dollars or a couple of thousand dollars to it.
Yeah, as a part of that bill also was some other things that probably going to be kind of significant, requirements on canvassing boards, requirements on people having minimum security standards to address the chains of custody regarding ballots and transportation of ballots. You heard a lot about some inconsistencies doing it. So a lot of things being added into that to sort of clean up the administration of how we administered our voting process.
Right.
And a lot of these issues, a lot of these things are people see in some ways to see in an offhand way, kind of voter suppression, or is this an opportunity for both parties to get more people on the rolls to vote? Do you see this as an opportunity to grow more people? Because we want more people to participate in the election process.
Well, I think it's an opportunity, definitely so, with Andrew Gillum going after 2 million additional voters to be registered. So it's definitely an opportunity for both sides. It's just how you go about it. And it's definitely making sure that our voters that are in the system of restoring their rights, that they're not fearful and they begin the process. Whatever mm-hmm. that process is, they begin the process. And so that was a negative to that bill. But there were some decent things that happened with that bill as well. In Duval County, we now are, throughout the state, there'll now be drop boxes set up for mm-hmm. people that like to do vote by mail ballots. They can drop them off at secure locations. The requirement for the staffs, the election staffs, to go through signature matching training is good with the VBM ballots. So it's a number of different things that were good. You know, you always see people on Facebook during the time of elections where they're in their booths taking pictures,
yeah.
but now it's legal actually to take a picture. And I want to preface that by saying people need to take a picture of themselves and their own ballot.
Yeah, not anyone else's.
Yeah. Right. And so it was a number of things that created decent steps toward cleaning up our election system. But adding the Amendment 4 to the elections law was definitely not a thing to do, along with the fees and the cost.
Okay, Tracy Davis is in the studio with us, State Representative, District 13. And let's go back to the phones. We have Chad on the line. Chad, good morning.
Good morning, Charles. So I had a quick question. We've heard how much Tracy Davis has done for Jacksonville and the great way that Representative Davis has served our city, and was wondering if we might have a little insight or input that could we see her name on the ballot in 2023 for mayor?
Oh, my.
I don't think so. Is that Chad? I don't think so, Chad. But thank you anyway.
All right. So people are projecting a nice political future for you here. And it is, you know, you've been doing for your constituents say you've been doing a great job. If, you know, they put you there twice. But what do you think are some of the major concerns regarding your district? Because I noted that when people are elected, they go, you know, they're there really to serve the state of Florida, but they want to make sure that their district is represented in a way that, some of the needs and things that the constituents have brought up to you are taken care of. What do you see there? And what do you tell your people at your town hall tonight about some of those concerns?
When I look at the representation of District 13, I look at the entire city and state. So education right now is a huge topic just across the board.
You can tell by this morning.
Yeah, education is huge. And I think a lot of constituents are paying attention to that. Regardless of what side of that issue you're on, it's really huge. And keeping our children safe and secure environments is really on the mind of people, period. And so when you're dealing with education, you're not just dealing with preparing our children for a global economy. You're wanting them to, you know, go to school and be in a safe and secure environment while they're there. Mm-hmm. And so education, of course, workforce training is always at the top of the list. Our infrastructure around Duval County is always on the list. And so, and along with economic development, you know, people are always interested in how we continue to bring jobs to the state of Florida as well as to Duval County.
Okay, great. We're going to take another call as we try to get as many as we get in before we lose you in the studio. Bill is on the line. Bill, good morning.
Yes. I just have a question. I voted for Amendment 4, and, I had a feeling that it would pass, and my thoughts at the time were, okay, now how are they going to change this so that these people can't vote, so that the ex-felons can't vote? Well, and I'm pretty upset about the whole thing, but let me ask you, is there a way that I could adopt an ex-felon and pay for their fees so that they could then vote?
Did you say Bill? Is your name Bill?
Yes, Bill.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Bill, I'll tell you when this first happened, and thank you for your comment. I'll tell you when I first...
Thank you, Bill, for the call.
I that was my first thought. Wow, let's put a fund together and try to help people who need to pay this restitution. And so I think the world hit me with, wow, that could be millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. But your comment, your idea is right on cue. And absolutely, if you are, that's just, you know, helping a brother out. That mm-hmm. is, it's helping another citizen out.
All right. So tell us quickly about the town hall meeting this evening, where it's going to be located, what time?
Town hall tonight is at 6. It's from 6 to 7:30. It will be held at Bradham Brooks Library on Edgewood Avenue, 1755 West Edgewood Avenue. And I'm just inviting everyone out so we can continue this great, robust conversation.
All right. State Representative Tracy Davis, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me, Charles.
Up next, a push to preserve Fish Island. This is First Coast Connect, and we'll be right back.
Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit wjct.org/events to explore what's coming your way.
I'm Lindsay Kilbride, host of WJCT's podcast, What It's Like. It starts with some of the best conversations recorded in Jacksonville by StoryCorps.
I remember being on the school bus and passing by and seeing you outside. You were under the addiction at the time.
And then I go deeper into the story.
How do you cope with the guilt you still feel? How do you cope with that?
Subscribe to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Jazz, the Great American Songbook, and your favorite oldies on Relax Radio at midnight, only on 89.9 FM, your community, your world.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. The North Florida Land Trust has been working to preserve Fish Island, a 57-acre property located on the Intercoastal Waterway, adjacent to the 312 Bridge, right just onto Anastasia Island. Yeah, for months, been working on that. But now they need your help. Jim McCarthy, president of North Florida Land Trust, joins us with more. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Charles.
Great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So
thank you.
Tell me about the actual Fish Island first. Let's set up Fish Island. Talk a little bit about that preserve and why it's so important.
Well, that's great. Well, first off, our mission, as you know, is to protect the natural resources, historic places, and working lands of North Florida. And this actually touches all of those points. If you look at it from that context, it is environmentally sensitive. It's 57 acres of maritime hammock. It's right on the Matanzas River. Mm-hmm. It's got about a mile of marshland, which helps significantly reduce flooding. Provides fisheries, does a number of different environmental, a number of environmental benefits from the marshlands. It's also historic in that it has, it was the original plantation, orange plantation, that Jesse Fish planted, who was quite a character, mm-hmm. As a lot of folks were in either the Wild West or the early days of Florida. He was a British citizen, actually, so the Spaniards actually befriended him, and he produced the first and exported oranges back in the mid-1700s. Which is just absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. In fact, he is attributed. It's the current citrus industry in Florida can be attributed to Jesse Fish because he began exporting both to Spain and to England, and they found the oranges had a much thinner skin and a much juicier inside than the oranges they were getting from the islands. So there was some tremendous historic value. There's actually some ruins mm-hmm. from his around 1750, his plantation then. And then it also, because it was a plantation, it was at one time a working land. And so it was it hits all three. And so it's a great piece. The citizens down there did a great job of working for it, wanting it preserved. We worked very hard to get that done.
So who currently owns it?
It's currently owned by a development company, Fish Island Development, and mm-hmm. Jim Young is the developer primarily. He's got a couple of partners, but Jim approached us actually about this island several months ago and about how to conserve it. He really came to the conclusion that it did need to be conserved, and without him, this would not have happened because he was a very willing seller.
It sounds like with all of the historical content and context around it, that this would be a no-brainer in trying to gather support for preservation of this property. So what is the problem, and how can people help?
Well, I'm not sure there is a problem yet, but we want to be sure. this is an unusual case for us. We have a brand new cabinet. The only person, as you probably know, is remaining is Jimmy Patronis. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, everybody's brand new. So we really don't know how they're going to react to acquisitions, to land acquisitions. So we want to be sure that we cross our T's and dot our I's. And the next step for us is to have the Board of Trustees or the cabinet vote accept our contract and to buy Fish Island. We want to be sure that that happens. So we do want to generate some, those folks who are interested in preserving Fish Island can certainly contact the cabinet aides, contact the members of the cabinet and express their viewpoints. Yeah. I don't think it's a problem, but we want to be sure because, like I said, we just don't know. We haven't had enough experience with the current cabinet yet.
Yeah. So what would happen if you did take possession, you ended up, North Florida Land Trust takes possession of the property. What happens then?
Well, actually, the way we hope it goes is that the state would take possession. Okay. So they don't. And with the city of St. Augustine has agreed to manage it.
Okay.
So it's really up to the city and the citizens of the city to decide how they want to manage it. It's an ideal for a passive park with some trails. It's got some beautiful shoreline and some beautiful birds. If you're when we were out there last, spoonbills were out there, and there were a number of different just a ton of wildlife out there. So it's a beautiful place to go visit.
Yeah, it sounds like a very nice piece of property. You know, there's so many pieces like that around Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, we just are so fortunate to have such really so many assets in the state of Florida. It's kind of hard to see sometimes that all of it's been so commercialized. But here's one of those opportunities where we get a chance to save something and preserve it for, you know, for the public to enjoy in its natural state.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that's our goal, is to find more of those. In fact, we've identified another one in just outside the city of St. Augustine that we'd like to acquire as well. But that one will probably be with private money,
mm-hmm.
Rather than because it's outside the Florida Forever boundaries. So, mm-hmm. But I agree with you. This is a unique place in that part of Florida and Florida history we want to preserve so that our kids and our grandkids can come and see it.
Yeah. So how can the public support what you're trying to do?
Well, right now with Fish Island, they can contact the cabinet or the cabinet aides, and they can find a list of those on our website. Or they can certainly contact us. Obviously, it's all about money when it comes down to it. We are a not-for-profit 501c3, so we do accept donations of both land and money, obviously. No firstborn children or precious gems, but actually, well, never mind. But in any event, anything along that lines that can support us, we'd certainly welcome any and all supporters.
Okay. Well, quickly, tell us, what else are you working on that may be really important?
Well, we've got another activity, another project that we'd like to do in St. Augustine. That's one, and then a couple in Clay County.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim McCarthy, North Florida Land Trust. Appreciate you being here this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And we'll be right back. And in a moment, we'll be talking about how to handle the Sunshine State during this holiday season for quick road trips. Right back.
I'm Lisa Mullins. What makes a terrific op-ed piece? One that might even make you change your mind about something. Trish Hall knows. She was the editor of the New York Times op-ed page, and she has pored through opinion pieces fantastic and feeble. She says the bad ones cover too much ground and use too much jargon. Tips on how to get your point across from the author of the new book, Writing to Persuade, next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
When markets are open, you can get second-by-second updates, but the action does not stop at the closing bell.
What should we do? How should we play this? Should we get in the market? Should we get out of the market?
I'm Kyle Risdahl. Trading After Hours, we'll have that story for you, the rest of the day's business news, and, of course, the numbers from Wall Street during the session, next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, the untold story of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. We talk with journalist Adam Higginbotham, author of Midnight in Chernobyl. He writes about the design flaws and shortcuts, human hubris, Soviet secrecy, and lack of imagination that led to the 1986 explosion. He talked to many eyewitnesses. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Democrats are debating how they can win. Former U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp is convinced the path to victory has to come from the center. But she's worried that her party is being pulled too far to the left. Heidi Heitkamp takes on the Twitter Democrats and makes the case for the middle. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, wondering what to do over the long holiday weekend, aside from watching the fireworks or a show or two? Well, you're in luck, because Jamie Rich of Flamingo Magazine is here with some ideas for Sunshine State road trips and possibly even staycations. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
Are you ready for the 4th?
I'm ready for the 4th, yes. I'll be traveling myself, so it'll be a good idea for us to have this conversation so I can know what to do.
Exactly. Well, Flamingo, this is our travel issue. It's on newsstands right now all over the state, and especially here in the Jacksonville area, so people can pick up a copy if they don't already have one. And we just want to inspire people to look at the state through a new lens and get inspired to go outside of their area, their comfort zone, and try something new. So we kind of have something for everybody in this issue. One of my favorite stories is more aimed at sort of the history buff or the space obsessed. Just down the road, it's a short distance to get in your car and head down to the Space Coast. And I've never seen a launch live until recently. And now you can just hop down the road. You can see a live space launch. That whole area is really bustling and growing so much. So that's a great activity for the whole family.
Yes, it's great. I mean, that's a great area. And I just happened to be watching the CNN special about Apollo 11 and just a video from when people were sitting in the bleachers. That area of the state is great. So that's a wonderful tip.
And this is the 50th anniversary, actually,
right,
of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. Mm-hmm. So July 20th, it'll be a special day. So that would be a great time to head down to the Kennedy Space Center and check it out. We also have something for ecotourists. If you're into wildlife habitats and just getting in touch with nature, but this one's a little further afield, so down in the Everglades. Mm-hmm. Every Floridian needs to experience the Everglades, right? And if you haven't, there's a special place in the southwest corner called 10,000 Islands, and we have a do-it-yourself guide, which kind of walks you through all the different things you can do, how you can get set up with fishing guides, kayaking, where to stay. So you don't have to have a professional to sort of hold your hand the whole time you're there.
Yeah.
But
that's good to know, because people, when they think about the Everglades, they think maybe danger, like alligators and snakes. But it's good to know that there are things you can do with the family, right? And
exactly.
Have some fun.
You can get up close and personal with wildlife, but not too close for comfort. But also you can kind of get a sense for some of the environmental issues that are impacting the state by getting an up close look at one of our most precious natural resources, which is the Everglades. And that's even on a national level. So it's great to get out there and experience it. So we have a special story, a big feature story on following a fishing guide and conservationist down there in 10,000 Islands this issue. So check that one out. Then we have something else for pet lovers, people who don't want to leave their dogs at home. They can bring them on the road. Mm. And there's actually a lot of really nice hotels, resorts, boutique hotels where you can take your pampered pooch along with you, big dogs, little dogs. And now these resorts are actually rolling out the red carpet for them.
Yeah, so I noticed most hotels now are pet friendly.
A lot of them are.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay.
So we have that. And also for the foodie, what we've realized is Tampa has actually emerged as one of the latest food destinations in the state. So many great restaurateurs, chefs, so much creativity coming out of that area of the state, mm-hmm. between St. Petersburg and Tampa, that it's really a culinary destination. So
now, why is that? Why are they ahead of the game? They're not supposed to be better than Jacksonville.
Well, Jacksonville's coming in very close, I will say. But, you know, forever it was one of those chain restaurant meccas, and just something clicked. I think a few key people in the area, key chefs, key restaurateurs, decided to sort of, you know, spearhead an effort to have more independent chefs, more independent restaurants, supporting that and growing that whole culture in the Tampa Bay area. And it's really something to experience. So check that story out. We have the best of, written by one of our a top culinary critic, Laura Riley. So that's a really awesome story.
Okay.
And then also we have for the staycationers, you know, just obviously reading the whole magazine will be a great thing to do.
Usually that's me, but not this weekend.
No, but you can take it on the road. That's the great thing about Flamingo. You can take it on the road if you're lounging by the beach, you're by the pool, and we have some great stories on fascinating Floridians. One of them is Tony Hale, who is actually appearing in Toy Story 4 right now. He's the voice of Forky, but he's a Floridian, and he was also on Veep. I don't know if you've ever watched Veep.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
He's the bag man. So we have a lot of great content. So if you're just staying at home, kicking back, lounging around, definitely pick up a copy and just get lost in the stories. Get inspired to plan your next trip.
Yeah. It's good to know that we're more than just a golf destination and beach destination for people coming outside of Florida. But for us residents, we have some things to do we can do here in Florida and enjoy ourselves as well.
There's so much rich culture in Florida. I try to basically just, we're kind of the antidote to the whole Florida man movement where things can get kind of, you know, going in a crazy direction. We say, no, Florida actually has so much rich culture and smart, amazing people doing really inspiring things. So that's the kind of thing we're highlighting in our pages. And beyond Disney, beyond South Beach, you know, there's a lot more to the Sunshine State, and that's what we're trying to showcase. So check it out.
All right. Thanks a lot. Watch out for Florida Man. Thank you, Jamie Rich, for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And get that Flamingo Magazine. And to our listeners, that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, go ahead and send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, former City Councilman Bill Gulliford will join us for an update on the fight against opioid epidemic here in Northeast Florida. That's tomorrow. I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.